doing, to do things. The state could do it. I'm trying to keep it as simple.
Well, we've waited nearly 10 minutes. You know, now we're on Senate time. It's a 10-minute late start, so I think we'll get going. I'd like to welcome everybody for being here today. We're just going to be having a variety of hearings and reports today. So first up, Mr. Buzicki from the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, please. Welcome to the committee. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Glad to have you here.
For the record, my name is Greg Buzicki. I'm the Division Director of the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division of the Department of Agriculture. And the first presentation is on our ACRA program. You should have a report in your package. The ACRA program is a 20-year-old program. I think most of the members here are familiar with the program and discussions, but let me just recap briefly. The program provides reimbursement to 80% of $350,000 for agricultural cleanups and agricultural chemical cleanups, and that is pesticides and fertilizers. Originally, it was thought of in the Groundwater Protection Act that a lot of facilities in particular had been involved in managing and handling pesticides and fertilizers, but really didn't know. Science wasn't there that spillage of some of this material on the ground at the facilities could lead to long-term contamination. So the fund was designed to clean up these ag facilities, and it's funded by ag dollars. It's basically surcharges on pesticides and fertilizers and licenses. So the agricultural community is paying its own way. Program has been in effect for a number of years. It has worked, I think, quite well. Overall, 450 sites across the state in both urban and rural areas have been remediated. About $28 million have been spent through this fund to conduct these cleanups. All the cleanups are a result of reporting discovery of an incident or, in some cases, an emergency spill to the department in a proper fashion. They're not the result of violations of the law, but accidents and incidents that have occurred. The department then provides oversight. Cleanups are usually involving an environmental contractor. And then the reimbursement application involves a public and private board, which contains representation from growers, retailers, and registrants, as well as a representative from the Department of Agriculture and a representative from the Department of Commerce. Last year, the board reviewed 31 applications. Total of a little bit over $1.2 million was paid in reimbursement. Total expenditures were about $1.4 million. Those additional expenditures provide support for the board and for staff. I think the administrative costs last year were about $170,000. Madam Chair, one of the issues that came before the Senate Ag Committee last year dealt with the Rushford flood. And as you well know, the facility at Rushford was severely impacted. The legislature passed some language that allowed the Rushford Co-op to come in without paying the $1,000 deductible and full reimbursement up to $350,000. In addition, the facility also had some historical contamination not related to the flood, so the department made the decision to treat those as two separate incidents. Obviously, the flood was unrelated to historical contamination. At this time, the Rushford Co-op has applied or received about a little over $65,000 $1 million. That's all they asked for. That primarily dealt with the waste pesticide that needed to be returned. There is, within the ACRA report here, there is a small update on that Rushford activity for your information. And we do anticipate that they will be proceeding with their historical site, and so more costs will be incurred on that particular site. But that, at this time, they have not expressed any additional costs related to the flood. So it worked. We thought, I think all of us thought, that there was a lot more financial impact on that facility that could be covered under the ACRA program. But as I said, they did not have to pay the 10% the 20% or the 1,000 deductible.
And Mr. Buzicki, I'll just say on behalf of Southeastern Minnesota to the Department of Ag, we're very grateful for the support and work that you provided us. It was a huge event, not only affecting the agricultural community and many other sectors, but this particular facility was of great concern to many folks down there because the facility actually burst, you know, and released fertilizer into the water, and Rushford was sitting there in kind of a stew for 3 days of raw waste and fertilizer and whatever was in people's garages. I'm surprised, too, it was so cost so little to get them set straight, but it was a great effort on your part, and I appreciate my colleagues and everyone else here for supporting that event and as well as the department, so thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you for those words. I will relay that to my staff and my commissioner. I will tell you that the staff, we operated an emergency operations center activated. We were going for about 3 weeks on that. There's a lot of people who participated in that at the department. And I would also say that we had outstanding cooperation with our partners over at the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health. So I'll relay those comments to them as well.
Thank you.
The last comment I would make with regard to the program is that the and you should have a map in your handout. It's the yellow state of Minnesota with a number of red dots. We do have a backlog of contaminated sites that we have been unable to provide the oversight and cleanup to in many of them. And the backlog is not only these historical sites that are indicated on the map. There's about 135 dots there. But there are other sites that we've become aware of, and that is simply a matter of the number of staff that we have. That's really the driving force. So the fund has been actually building the last few years, and we are hopeful that we'll be able to add some staff to the program so we can process through and evaluate more of these sites. The map that's before you is actually 135 sites the result of a review of 450 abandoned agricultural chemical sites locations of one sort or another. These would be, for ease of understanding, these would be ag chem facilities that have gone out of business and perhaps were in the process of being converted to some other use. Several years ago, GPSed those 450 sites. We've evaluated them, and we determined that about 150 of them actually need a more detailed evaluation. We've been able to work on about 15 of them, but we still have 135 just in the historical category that we need to address. It's important that we address these sooner rather than later, because if in a particular case we do have contamination at depth of pesticides and fertilizers, eventually that will move to groundwater, and it's a lot easier to get it sooner rather than later. So I just wanted to bring to the committee's attention, though, that we do recognize that the fund is building. We do recognize that we are short-staffed right now, and we're going to be trying to address that issue so we can get to more of these sites.
Okay. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bruski, these sites you have identified here, how old are these sites? Am I missing that? When you talk about the contaminants in the soil getting into the groundwater, how old are they? And is there any kind of an emergency type basis with any of these?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebretson, we have prioritized those, and we don't believe that we're dealing with emergency situations, but of course we can't be certain. I wouldn't, as I said, we're beginning to work on some of the higher priorities. About 300 of the sites, for one reason or another, we determined that there was no need to do any further activity on it. So these are sites that we are seriously concerned about. We'd like to get to them sooner rather than later. As far as how old they are, it all depends on the exact nature of the specific site. Some of these would have been old facilities. Some of these might have been location where a spill had occurred that we had recorded. So the bottom line is we don't know in all cases, and each site has their own characteristics, but we've been able to screen out about two-thirds, and we would like to get to these as soon as we can. But my staff don't believe at this time, based on what we know, that we're dealing with an emergency situation.
Okay. Mr. Buzik, I have two questions, and one was related to Senator Ingebretson's. Could you tell us a little bit about how you prioritize these things? My question was the same. Being, you know, a nurse, we triage things and try to get to the highest priority things, you know, in a timely manner. Are these all prioritized, and how many are in a really critical category, or are these entire 150 in a critical category? And then this only shows the 150 or 135 that you're talking about. If we were to look at the locations of the 500, would it be generally speaking in the same geographical pattern that we're looking at here?
Madam Chair, to your last question, the answer to that would be yes. This is a pretty typical pattern that we see. The main area of the state that where we don't see much agricultural activity, as you well know, is in the forested areas. As for how we evaluate those sites, and to give you a detailed answer to your question, I'd have to go back and do some ask staff for more detailed analysis. But with all of our sites, we evaluate them as to a variety of factors, actually using a United States Environmental Protection Agency Superfund scoring system. So each site individually is looked at for its location with regard to receptors, such as drinking water wells, what the soil types are, what the historical nature of the facility was, any kind of information that we might have on that. I will tell you, so for some of these, we don't have much information, for example. But some of them we do have some records on, and so there's a little bit of detective work that goes in, and then that's the basis of that prioritization as to what potential impacts or if we had anything in our old files. This was actually an effort that staff undertook several years ago because we have encountered these historically. We knew there was a lot more out there. Some actually became sites where we had to clean up. A lot of them became sites that we could check off and not clean up. So we actually applied to EPA to get some funding to go out and locate these before we lost the institutional knowledge of where they were. And so it's good that we have those. I don't want to alarm the committee by any imagination. I'd be happy to go back and provide you with more detailed information from my staff. The main point I wanted to let you know is that we do have additional sites and work that's already in our files. These are just the historical ones. We also have other types of sites also. So we've got a lot of work to do. It's far from over.
Well, thank you, Mr. Buzicki. I think this committee would be real interested in finding out some more details on these sites. And then I would hope and imagine with some of the new legacy money coming in that has to do with clean water, if some of these sites are related to aquifer or aquifer risk and water risk, that, you know, you might be in alignment for some funding, I would hope, through that fund. So, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Buzicki, I'm not exactly sure. I think this is a good year to be building fund balances, but my question is this money dedicated only to cleanup, or is the department going to use it for something else?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I agree with you. We had some staff leave the program, and So we have some vacancies. And the vacancies, are the program staff are actually covered by our pesticide regulatory account, which is our general pesticide regulatory program. The money in this account is dedicated to the reimbursement activities, with the exception of, I believe it's $275,000 by statute is allotted for staff processing the applications and the ACRA board expenses and the actual application process. So a small component is used for staff, the rest is used for cleanup. We can't get to that, we can't process that because we don't have enough hydrologists and soil scientists to provide the oversight. And I would, Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, add one other thing. We actually are involved with Superfund cleanups. You may be aware of that or recall that. And we have a number of those, and they've actually been taking a lot more of our staff's time than they have in past years. So that's part of the other reason. We're a pretty skinny ship down there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Bezicki. Can you give us just a short idea of how long it takes to evaluate, say, one of these sites? What type of person hours it takes to get an understanding of what the problem is, the depth of the problem?
I can, Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey. It's a relatively short period of time. It's based on how much information we have. It's generally staff office time, reviewing paperwork. These are hydrologists and geologists who know soil types and well construction and those kinds of things pretty well. It's a matter of a few hours to go through, and it depends on how much information we have on it. What information is available, you know, the soil types and that type of thing. But I would imagine on the order of a few hours to evaluate each one of those, plug it into a scoring formula, and then come out develop a score for each one.
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Do you have the expertise within your department to do all of that, the hydrologists, the soil scientists, and everybody that you need within your own department to do the complete assessment?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator, we have an experienced staff that's been doing this for years. We just don't have enough of them to do all of the work that's necessary. We actually use, and going through this process, we actually use some of the state Superfund money, MRLA. We're partners with the Pollution Control Agency, and we use some of that funds to actually help with scoring to make sure that we run everything through the system and then prioritize and assign staff to those priorities. Each one of the project managers, once we get to a project being assigned, may have 20, 25 cases that they're dealing with at any given time.
Okay, thank you.
Right,
is that the end of your report?
Madam Chair, did you want to go with the Agricultural Fertilizer Research Council or...
Well, as long as you're at the table, why don't we skip down to the waste pesticide piece?
Madam Chair and committee members, this is a status report on the waste pesticide collection program. It's a six-month report, so it's very skinny, but we know that the committee is interested in this issue. There were, just as a bit of background, the department has been collecting waste pesticides since 1989. This has been a very successful program. It has gone through an evolution to be modified in three different ways, and we don't need to go into that in total. However, in 2003, there were changes made to the program, in part because of fiscal concerns, but basically to have counties and regional household hazardous waste organizations do all the collections for agriculture and residential. Prior to that, they had focused mostly on residential, and the department for about 15 years had been doing all the ag waste collections. That program involved some controversy, in part because there wasn't a lot of dollars that was being devoted to it, and that resulted in a 2006 task force. The legislature directed the task force to meet. This included many agricultural organizations, commodity groups, and county folks. And Senator Vickerman, as well as Representative Junkie, were part of that task force. They recommended some changes, and in 2007, you passed legislation to enact those changes. Just touch on the major changes to the programs, or to the program. The Department of Agriculture was assigned the responsibility to conduct a waste pesticide collection for agriculture in every county each year. The Department of Agriculture was also assigned the responsibility to collect periodic collections for residential pesticides in every county each year. We interpreted that as at least twice. And the department was to do that unless there was an agreement with the counties. And the counties were free to choose to do no collections, to collect one residential pesticides or agriculture pesticides. There was no dollar limit assigned to the program. The program is being funded by the pesticide regulatory account. And the department was directed to pay overhead costs and to pay for advertising and other program costs that the counties may incur. And Madam Chair, for ease of conversation, I'm going to refer to the county associated programs or the counties, but some of these are household hazardous waste regional programs. So just for ease of conversation, because across the state, as I think you're well aware of, different groups do different things. So I'll just refer to this as the county. The department coordinated with the county representatives through a series of meetings. Actually, prior to the prior to July 1st, and we were trying to determine what is the best and the fastest manner to implement these new programs. For example, we listened to the county's concerns about various things and tried to address them. As far as the overhead costs that the counties encountered, the counties and the department determined that the simplest and most cost-effective way was simply to pay overhead costs at a rate of $25 per pound of waste pesticide collected. And so we tried to resolve all the issues and move forward as best we could. There are 74 counties, 75 counties that have communicated to us in a written fashion how they would like to proceed. 37 of the counties have signed agreements with us to collect both ag and residential, and an equal number, 37, have signed agreements for only agriculture or for only residential. One county decided not to do any collection, have the department do it, and the remaining counties, we have not heard anything in writing from them. They are not participating, so the department is going into those counties and doing collections. Before you, you have a summary of what's happened in our program, pounds of waste collected. You'll see in the center of the page a little bit about the program costs. These do exclude MDA administration costs, staff costs, and they also exclude any costs that have been incurred by the counties. But this is money that has gone out of the department to pay for pesticide disposal. For either that has been collected by the county-associated pickups or by the department. And you also have information about the reasonable overhead costs and how much we paid for an advertising.
Mr. Buzicki, just back to the cooperative agreements for a moment.
Sure.
Could you give us some sort of understanding as to what the counties may have been thinking or their reasoning in deciding to only collect residential waste or to do both, or to opt out entirely?
Madam Chair, sure. There was a lot of discussion about the fact that the department had not been collecting on its regular basis for several years. The previous legislation, most of the program required us to go out and do collections in half the state each year. So we would get to every county basically twice, once every 2 years. Since we hadn't done that and the counties were actually doing most of the collection for the past half a dozen years or so, there was concern that there was a lot of agricultural chemical that had built up in farms and so forth. Mm-hmm. So a number of the counties expressed concern what was really out there with regard to agricultural chemicals. They were pretty comfortable with dealing with the household waste, the lawn and garden stuff, but not the farm stuff. And so about half of them said took a wait-and-see approach, see if there was going to be a flood of agricultural chemicals.
So were the counties then worried about storing that material until the department could get around in collecting it? Is that where some of the concern was?
Madam Chair, I think that may have been part of it, if they were caught with a lot of it. I think there was just a general unknown, and I think the thought was, why don't we let the Ag Department go out and test the waters first before we start? My experience is with, even when we delegated the program entirely to the counties, the household hazardous waste folks are much more comfortable and familiar dealing with garden and residential materials than dealing with growers. Some do it very well. I don't want anybody to misunderstand. But generally, their main customer is the urban folks, the lawn and garden paint, as opposed to the farm folks. And, of course, traditionally, that's our bread and butter. We're pretty good at working with growers, and we've got our network working and working with growers. And I think the numbers reflect that. That is the counties and the department have collected, if you look at that little table over on the right-hand side, an equal amount of waste pesticide, about 148,000 pounds. But you can see that the counties have done an excellent job in collecting residential, and our bread and butter is in the ag sector. Madam Chair, I would just mention to the committee that we will not know the final cost of this program. We had completed fiscal notes based on the program as it stood last year, of course, and this is brand new for us in collecting in conducting a program in this fashion. But we still have a number of counties where we have to go back and do residential. That's 13 counties. The department has conducted ag collections in all the counties that we were required to. The residential or the counties still will be collecting a lot of residential waste pesticide, or for those that agreed to do the agricultural materials as well, this spring. And as they collect that and the vendor picks it up from them, then we will get a better idea of how much pesticide will be coming in the spring. So the bottom line in terms of cost of the program, we won't know the exact cost of the program until after the end of the fiscal year, because there's still quite a bit of work to do. But I would say that we've done an awful lot in 6 months, and we've learned an awful lot, and we'll probably be coming back to the committee with some minor technical amendments to the program. I won't go through the issues and comments on the second page, but if you have the time, you can take a look at those, and you can see some of the practical observations that have been brought forward. For the committee's interest, there is a table, a one-page table on page 3, and that compares what we have done in the 50 counties that we collected in 2008 and compared it to the most recent period when we were collecting it in the same fashion, which would have been during that period of 2000 to 2003. And you can see that we're basically collecting about 2.5 times. That's not an overwhelming amount, considering that the ag folks really haven't had an excellent vehicle to get this material into a collection site in the past years. One of our concerns, frankly, and I'll tell you, it only came to pass at one time. We were concerned that that a tremendous amount of waste pesticide might come in from various sources. And in fact, we had only one instance where we had, it was about 21,000 pounds come in, spur of the moment, from one facility, and that was a very unusual situation. It was complicated, but the bottom line is this was brand new product, but because there'd been some merging of some organizations, they couldn't sell it under the new business arrangement. And so we actually disposed of 21,000 pounds of brand new pesticide that could have been used, but since we didn't have the authority to turn them away or to handle it any other way, we had to dispose of it. So.
Okay. Mr. Buzicki, I believe Senator Ingebrigtsen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That leads into the question, how do you dispose of all this?
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we, along with the Pollution Control Agency, have a master contract for the disposal of hazardous material, several companies, actually. So they are already under contract, and that takes the agencies do that each by item, so contract. So the material is collected and stored either at the at a county or our household hazardous waste regional operation until the contractor actually can come and pick that up. That contractor is a licensed contractor. The material is overpacked into containers so it can be safely transported, and that material is trucked out of state and to a licensed hazardous waste incinerator, which is located, I think it usually goes to one in Illinois, if I'm not mistaken. For our collections, we, staff at the Department of Agriculture, do not do hands-on collection. Provide oversight and arrangements, and we may actually be on site, but the contractor actually is dispatched on a route that we determine to collection sites that we've developed, usually with our agricultural chemical facilities, our common host for these. There will be advertising in advance. We will send out postcards to farmers, all kinds of advertising at the local and larger level, saying this is the location of the sites, and then farmers will come in on that particular day. The material will be checked in, inventoried. It will be overpacked, and the truck will be out. It's usually a one-day operation. So it's a very slick operation, actually.
Follow-up, Senator.
Just a follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So farmer brings it in. Is there a fee that he has to pay to get rid of it?
Madam Chair, Senator, no.
Okay.
This is all free.
Senator Dale, did you have a question?
Well, Madam Chair, members, as we listen to all these reports and hear more about what state government is doing, in this current economic condition that we're in, we have to look for ways to suspend some operations and save money for more critical operations. And in my view, we need to limit any new regulations we put on either the private or public sector and make sure we're not spending any new money that on programs that are not really critical. And I'm wondering if, Mr. Buzicki, is there anything you're doing that where we could just suspend operations for a couple of years and use your money for some other purpose to try to get past this economic crisis that we're in? Or is everything you're doing absolutely critical that has to be done right now?
Madam Chair, Senator Dill, thank you for that question. Madam Chair, Senator, we have responsibilities assigned to us in statute, and I can assure you that that we try all the time to improve our efficiencies, to be as effective as we can. Our actual staff has dropped in recent years. We do have concerns about our pesticide regulatory account, and we actually express those concerns, I think, far before the general fund concerns have developed. I don't have anything to offer right now. We know this particular program is a very expensive way to go about ridding waste pesticides, but it was the legislature's direction that we do it this way, and to succeed, we We may have some cost-saving ideas in this particular program. Where I can administratively improve efficiencies, I sure try to do it all the time. Right now, for example, we're looking at ways that we can host, that we can participate in training sessions and workshops using telecommunications rather than sending people on the road. But most of what we do, Senator, is, Madam Chair and Senator, is directed by the legislature.
Yeah.
Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, members, I just wondering if it makes much difference whether we pick up the waste pesticide this year or we pick it up in 3 years. You know, we're really in such a bind that we've got to think about things like this, and maybe we need to, maybe it's all going to work out in the end with a big chunk of money coming from the federal government, but on the other hand, there's certain things state government really has to do that's extremely important, and these waste pesticides could just as well set in somebody's machine shed an extra year or two or three, and we can pick them up later and maybe put you to work doing something else.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator, I will acknowledge this program. This program was and still is one of the best in the nation in terms of the collection of waste pesticides. Minnesota growers should be congratulated for their stewardship in keeping this material until it could be properly disposed of. And we're one of the top two or three in the country in actual disposal of waste pesticides. But for many years, this program operated on an every other year basis. And when you look at the numbers, you can make a case that might not be a bad model, or at least if you look at some of these amounts, a few hundred pounds that are being picked up, it sure doesn't look like it's going to pay for us to go back to some of these small ag communities and spend all the money just to go get a few hundred pounds. So that might be an option right there.
And
we will be talking of bringing some legislation forward for discussion.
And Mr. Buzicki, I have a question to you related to this, and maybe Bill Bond, who represents the ag chemical producers, can answer this question. But don't the ag producers or the chemical producers pay a fee up front that has to do with covering the costs of disposal? And does that 100% cover the cost? And if it does, because we have the same kind of mechanism in the healthcare sector where we require producers or providers to pay a fee, they don't want to see that fee being paid for fixing roads. So I'm not sure who's best able to answer that question. Mr. Buzicki.
Madam Chair, there is a task force report from the Waste Pesticide Task Force a year or so ago that actually contains financial information. I'd be happy to provide that to you and the committee. And, of course, I'll be talking about this when we bring our budget forward. But you are correct. All of this money, all of the things that we do in pesticide regulation, whether it's in investigations of misuse or waste pesticide disposal, is paid for by the pesticide regulatory account. And one of our concerns was, since this program has no limitations on it, as the person who manages that account, that, you know, I wouldn't do that to my daughter. Here, have this account. Go ahead. But we're fortunate because the costs that have come in so far are manageable. Previously, we were spending about $400,000 in this program. Right now, it looks like we'll probably be spending about $1 million. But it could have been a lot more. We just weren't sure what we were going to find. Having said that, we did bring to the attention to the budget committees that the pesticide regulatory account reserve is very low, and we are very concerned about that.
And that's a dedicated account?
Chair, that's correct. That is dedicated. So okay. The registrants and the basically gets passed to the farmer one way or another are paying for this program through the fees that are paid into the pesticide account.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Buzicki, I didn't know Senator Dill was going to ask that question, but I think it's a good one. But isn't this I don't know about the household waste part of it, but it seems to me that the farm side of it should be a reducing number. And part of that is because of the practice of farmers buying in large containers where if there's some chemical left in the container, they weigh it and they take it back. And so there isn't anything left over on the farm. I mean, it was different when everybody bought 1 gallon jugs or 2.5 gallon jugs, but that practice is getting less and less, I would think. And, you know, isn't that side of it getting to be a smaller and smaller number all along?
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, that's a very good observation. We in agriculture have always kept detailed records about what pesticides are coming in. So we actually have that data for the collections that we've been in charge of. Now, it's actually one of the concerns expressed by the counties is the amount of record keeping that the legislation that was passed last year required. But we felt it was important to know exactly how much is coming in so that we understand what's taking place out there. Very simply, farmers in Minnesota have done an outstanding job of keeping their waste pesticides. We still receive DDT in containers that are many, many years old. And we have that record. We believe that there's going to be a steady stream, and when you think about it, there's been farms that have gone out of business or been passed on to the sons and daughters, and they've cleaned out. But one of the things is that we understand is that there's only a relatively small percentage of growers that participate each year because, well, they're busy or, you know, there's a doctor's appointment or the day just doesn't work and so forth. So what we think is we're just getting 1%, 2%, 3% participation each year. So when you think about that at say 4%, it's going to take 25 years less for that system. And that's not a bad thing because if farmers are keeping their material, they can bring it in next year or the year after. It's not causing environmental problems. And at the same time, we don't get overloaded. So it's a manageable amount. If everyone were to bring it in 1 year, I wouldn't have enough money to pay for it.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Buzicki, anything else?
Madam Chair, welcome back.
All of you. That's all.
Okay, thank you. Questions or further comments from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. I think we'll move on to Mr. Montgomery from the Department of Ag for an overview on the Minnesota Ag Fertilizer Research and Education Council. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Montgomery.
Thank you very much. And for the record, my name is Bruce Montgomery. I'm the unit supervisor of the fertilizer management unit that's contained within the Pesticide and Fertilizer Management Division at the department. First of all, thanks very much for the opportunity to serve you today. I'd like to just hit upon 3 points. We'll keep this very brief. And what I'd like to do is first just give you a very quick report on the progress of the Ag Fertilizer Research and Education Council. This is a very new program, and they've gotten a lot to report to about the last 12 months. But before I do that, I'd also like to comment that we would like to then give you a little bit of a report on the types of projects that were funded through the general funds over the last year, and then last, leave a few minutes for questions if you have any. A number of you are probably familiar with the concept of fertilizer checkoffs for funding soil fertility research. A number of you have been involved with these programs. For those of you that are not, a number of our Midwestern states have had programs in place for the last 20 to 30 years, particularly the Midwestern states. These programs have a general mission of providing research to address improved fertilizer use efficiency, improve yields, research environmental concerns that are associated with the use of fertilizer products, develop best management practices, and also a very important role also is to serve as for educating farmers and dealers on the use of those products. In 2005, the legislature was passed directing the Department of Ag to assemble what was called the Ag Nutrient Task Force. One of those purposes was to determine if there was a need for such a program in the state of Minnesota, and if so, how was it going to be funded and for how much. I'd like to thank Senator Dill and Senator Vickerman, as well as Representative Junkie and Blaine, for participating in that task force that met a number of times throughout the winter of 2005 and 2006, and a report was given to the legislature in the spring of 2006, which did recommend that, yes, indeed, additional fertilizer research is needed in the state of Minnesota to keep up with current production ag, that the program should be funded through an increase in fertilizer tonnage fees, and also that the fees must be refundable. That proposed legislation that went forward to create the program did not pass, as many of you know, in 2007. However, there was a one-time allocation of $600,000 from the general fund that was approved for the council to get started, to see if it would work, and then to get some research projects moving forward. What I'd like to do is talk a little bit about off the sheet that's in your packet with all of the state maps on it, and just give you a real quick overview of what some of the projects that were funded out of the $600,000. The council had to obviously identify a number of research priorities before they could go forward with it, and I'll talk about those accomplishments in just a second. But just to kind of give you a flavor of the types of projects that were funded, I've got these broken up into four different broad categories. The first one is really more on the production ag associated with our three major nutrients. For those of you that have farmed, you realize that phosphorus, nitrogen, and potassium are main fertilizer components. And the first four projects really deal with the production ag sides of those. I'll just pick out one project, and we can talk more about the other ones if you have additional questions later. But I'll just jump down to the fertilizer requirements for native perennial plants harvested for biomass. A lot of interest both on the state and the national level about using crops like switchgrass for bioenergy, using native prairie grass. The reality is we know very little about how to fertilize these cropping systems. And this particular project over 2 years would provide a lot of useful information on coming up with nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium recommendations if we go forward with movement on using those for bioenergy. As many of you know, our yields have increased dramatically over the last few decades, and there's a number of many different reasons for that, including better weed control, better tillage practices, and also hybrid selections is a very critical one. There's a lot of concerns from growers that micronutrients and sulfur are deficient in some of our cropping systems. One thing that's really interesting is that these recommendations change over time, and because we've done a pretty good job of cleaning up atmospheric pollution, and that has a major contributor for sources like phosphorus, and over the years these phosphorus levels have, the wet fall deposition of sulfur has decreased fairly dramatically. Now there's some concerns that we're probably going to be running deficient in our cropping systems, particularly as we increase our yields, particularly in crops like corn, where we've seen those yields go up significantly. So there's two projects to focus on not only sulfur, but also zinc. And we're relying on our partners from the experiment stations to help us resolve some of those problems. The council felt that water quality obviously was a great concern as well, and the C category really focuses on water quality impacts associated with fertilizer use, and we have two projects, one located at the Southern Research and Outreach Center at Waseca, and the other a satellite from the Lamberton Station to help all of us better understand what some of those water quality implications are from our cropping systems. Education is also a key component to the council, and the last project helped fund the printing and distribution of a whole new series of nitrogen BMPs that have been distributed hard copy-wise, as well as making it readily available for the website. So there's 9 projects that are funded. These all started as of this spring. It was only through the tremendous activities, and I tried to list some of the accomplishments of the Research Council in fairly succinct fashion. But keep in mind that this council officially didn't start till January 1 of 2008. Since that time, they've held some very productive meetings and gotten an awful lot done, including the development of their bylaws, developing their internal operating procedures, and they were utilizing the recommendations from the Ag Nutrient Task Force to proceed using that for the guiding principles. The council had to quickly identify what those research needs were that were in Minnesota that need to be taken care of. The department provided assistance to the council for developing the grants program, and we used an RFP process. So all of this had to be done very quickly over approximately a 6 to 8 week period to get that RFP out in time. And then the council reviewed 19 projects. It was very well received by the university and other research entities. In February, listened to all 19 projects and very quickly decided on which 9 were going to be funded. Obviously, they didn't have enough money to fund all of the projects. We had $552,000 of funding, and we had approximately $1.2 million in requests. The council funded as many of them as they could, and the Minnesota Corn Growers funded 2 additional projects out of there. So there was a total of 11 projects that did receive funding when it was all said and done. I think the council really, the overall program is really an excellent example of how legislators, commodity groups, state government, researchers can all work together on a common goal. And if it wasn't for the hard work of all of those entities, this never would have got done in time that we could write the contracts, get all the work in place, and have things ready to go by April. All 9 projects are up and running, and the longevity of those will be anywhere from 2 to 4 years. The Minnesota Crop Retailers also provided an excellent opportunity to showcase a number of these projects in December at their short course. That's a very well-represented program that many of our ag fertilizer dealerships and farm organizations, ag professionals, attend that. And many of these programs were showcased at that particular event. I guess with that, I'd like to just say that the program has gone exceptionally well considering the short amount of time that we've had to deal with, and we appreciate your support, and I'd be glad to take any questions. We have a number of people that in the audience that have been active or active on the council. If you look at the trifold on the back side, the 12 memberships are listed on the back side there. If you have a question about who's representing which organization, a number of them are here today. And I think between all of us, we could probably answer many of your questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Montgomery, the grants that you're showing and the projects that have been initiated, and you've got costs associated with each of the categories of these. Mm-hmm. Are these annual costs? In other words, are these the costs? Is it an annual cost to support these 4 projects in the A category, $300,000? Is that going to have to be about the level of support required to keep these things going over the 4 or 5 years of duration? Is that an accurate understanding?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, the money amounts that are there for the entire length of the project. So, again, these projects vary in longevity. Most of them are actually field projects with the exception of the educational program on the backside. So the minimum length of project is 2 years, and some of them run as long as 4 years. So the numbers I had front of you are for the entire length of that duration.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Montgomery? Okay, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear an update on the bovine TB control and eradication efforts. Joe Martin, Bill Hartman, and Michelle Carsonson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Joe Martin. I currently serve as the Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. With me today is, as you said, is Dr. Hartman from the Board of Animal Health and Michelle Carstensen from the DNR. They'll provide some additional information as we get into the presentation a bit. So, like I said, I serve as the Assistant Commissioner at the Department. I have primarily oversight over several of our regulatory divisions. Many of the things that you heard earlier in the committee, I oversee. And I was very busy up until about last March when TB situation started getting quite heated, and that's when the governor had asked me to serve as a statewide bovine TB coordinator, which basically is a fancy way of saying that to integrate interagency activities in the incident command system. So basically can say it's been a busy year, but it's been a successful year. And I know many of you know sort of the context behind this, but I think briefly, if I could, I'll just give a sort of a background of how we got to where we're at now and then going forward. So basically, how we got to this point is we struggled with bovine TB in the state for a long time, up until about 1976, when the state of Minnesota regained TB-free status. Before that, we were pretty much endemic with TB in the state, within dairy herds and also dealing with TB in humans. We enjoyed that designation from 76 till about 2005, when unfortunately we found a herd in Roseau County that was found infected with TB. That herd was found via regular market inspection. There was an animal sent to Green Bay Slaughter Plant. A federal inspector found an animal with TB lesions. And that herd was first confirmed in 2005, which sort of set us on this journey of dealing with TB. Unfortunately, that following fall, we found, via increased testing in the area, we found four additional herds. And then we also started, DNR started surveillance of the deer herd and found problems with the deer herd. So that's, we knew we had a problem. And that took us to... And then I guess what also had happened at about that time when we found the four herds, that led to this official, which we all become familiar with, of status downgrades, where we had the first downgrade from the USDA, which leads to additional testing restrictions by cattle producers who are sending cattle across state lines. So the state got downgraded. That takes us to around 2006, and many of this is, I think this timeline's in your report too that you can read if you want more details. But in fall 2006, via additional testing, we found two additional affected herds. We also found additional deer that were infected, basically saying that, confirming that the problem was getting a little bit worse. As you can see, everything is sort of going, we were sort of triaging up as we found out more about this. So that year, knowing that we had a problem, we needed to basically verify, was this a statewide problem or was this a localized problem? So there was basically a lot of cattle testing statewide along with testing deer statewide. It was a lot of work, but it was produced good results because out of all that testing of cattle and deer, we found no positive animals outside of a small region in northwest Minnesota. That took us to around the fall of 2007 of last year, where we found another four cattle herds. And that's what really set, dramatically increased what happened up there, because we're only allowed to find so many herds a year. And when we found those four herds, that's when the entire state dropped another status to modified accredited, which sort of set off the flurry of events that you heard last legislative session. I'd also add that because of that, last winter saw more aggressive deer removal efforts than had been seen in years past, too. Just as that sort of takes us through the timeline a little bit, just to many of you remember this, a little bit what happened last legislative session, the TB bill that was signed, there was an authorization of $3.35 million. For herd buyouts, annual payments, and exclusionary fencing. Also was authorized was $472,000 in fiscal year 08 and $2.172 million in 09 to the Board of Animal Health for their administration and enforcement activities. Also in that bill was the BAH was granted additional but necessary authorities to implement the strategy, pursue split state status, which fortunately we have received, and also to there's two related issues to this. We authorized a per-head assessment that is now in effect where we're collecting money on cattle sales, and also due to the efforts of Senator Scoy, there is property tax relief for the herd owners in the area. So with that, that concludes my introductory remarks, and what we'd sort of planned is Dr. Hartman from the board can give us and give you and the committee an update in terms of the outcomes of the year.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Senator Hand, do you have a question? All right, thank you. We'll go on to Dr. Hartman.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hartman. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Animal Health and the State Veterinarian. The first thing I wanted to do is thank everyone for the tremendous support the Board of Animal Health has gotten in this effort. It has allowed us to begin the process of successfully getting rid of this disease in this area. You have a handout in your packet that says State of Minnesota Bovine TB Response. This kind of outlines what I'm going to be talking about. And then on the back of that document, there's a map, and I'll be referring to that map. So if you have that in front of you, that would be helpful. There's two things that we wanted to accomplish on the livestock side. The first was to get the split state status. Since Minnesota had dropped two levels in status that USDA gives us to move cattle interstate, it was important that we raise the status of the majority of the state, and to do that, we had to do zoning. So we developed two zones, a modified accredited advanced zone and a modified accredited zone, and that's what's pictured on this map. The dark outlined area is the part in northwestern Minnesota that is modified accredited advanced. And I'm going to just walk through how that happened. And it was also important to allow us to focus our resources up in that area. We didn't need to be testing cattle herds down in southern Minnesota. We were pretty sure after all the surveillance we did that there was an infection down there. So we wanted to spend the money up where we knew where we had the disease. It was a big job accomplishing the split state status. Normally in other states it's taken a year or longer to accomplish. With USDA's help, we got it done in 6 months. And this was critically important because part of this modified accredited status we had would have required that any of the calves that we sold out of state that they have a TB test. And there are about 200,000 of those that leave Minnesota to get fed in other states, so it was important that that testing not happen. The first step in this process was USDA did a risk assessment. So they sent some people here, two people here. They looked at what we were proposing for these different zones and whether they thought it would work, whether we could contain the disease adequately. The second step then was for us to implement this split state status. And what that meant is that this area up in northwestern Minnesota, we had to treat it like another state. So we had to put in movement controls in this part of the state so that anything going into the zone, anything moving within the zone or leaving the zone was tracked by us and had the proper testing to be able to do that. Then the next step was that USDA sent a review team here, and the review team they sent were six people. They were here for a week, and they had a report that was about, I think it was about 40 pages that we got from that. I skipped a step. Before that, we did an application to USDA for this status, and I was going to bring that application, but it was almost too heavy to carry. It was over 400 pages and weighed 7 pounds. I'm kind of a weakling. I couldn't carry it. Anyway, it was a very complicated process to do this application. They sent the review team. They did their report, and we did get split state status October 10th of 2008, and I said that was important. That status is being acknowledged by most states, but with the notable exceptions of North Dakota and Wisconsin have not acknowledged that. So those states still consider Minnesota the entire state modified accredited. After attaining that status, we have to continue to maintain these two zones, so treat that area like a separate state. As part of the split state status, we have to test all the cattle, bison, goat, and farm cervidae herds in that area. And Senator Scoey, I'm sorry, but we found out there's 384 herds in that area. So there's a little bit more than what we thought. There's about 18,000 animals, and all of those animals have been tested in that zone. And the good news is we didn't find any more infection. So things are going good that way. Government veterinarians from the Board of Animal Health and from USDA did about 60% of the testing, and 40% of it was done by private practitioners that were reimbursed by the state for the testing. Those herds will all have to have a wildlife risk assessment done in their farms, and they'll have to develop herd plans to figure out ways of keeping the deer and particularly the cattle feed separate so that we don't, if we do have any infection in deer anymore, that doesn't spread back to our cattle. And then I mentioned before that we have to monitor the movement of all cattle going into the zone, moving within the zone, and leaving the zone. So we need to make sure that everything is individually identified and we can monitor it. In the MAA zone, so the majority of the state, we're going to have to do some surveillance yet in that zone to prove that we don't have any disease, and we're still negotiating with USDA on how much testing we need to do. It's somewhere between probably 600 and 1,500 herds that we're going to have to test as part of that. So I mentioned there were two things we were going to do. That was the first, to get split state status. The second is to decrease the chance of spread of this disease between the deer and the cattle in a particular area where we found infection in the deer. And that's an area called the management zone. And again, if you look at this map, that is this outer kind of jagged circle on the map. So it's an area where we know we've had infection in deer in the past. And so to do this, we did two things. The first thing was to offer a voluntary buyout of cattle herds in that area. And there turns out there were 68 cattle herds that were eligible for this buyout, and there were 46 of them that signed contracts with us. Those herds had about 6,200 head of cattle in them. And about 1,000 of them are left yet to be removed. If you remember, they all have to be out of that zone by January 31st of this year. So there are about 1,000 head left, but that means over 5,000 head have left the area. So far, we've paid out a little over $1 million to that buyout, and the total cost of the buyout when we're done will be about $3 million. If you remember, the law provided that not only would there be that one-time payout for the buyout, but then there would be an annual payment to these herd owners, and those annual payments will come to about $500,000 a year. In the buyout so far, we found one herd that sent some of its cows to slaughter, and three of those animals at slaughter were found infected. So this just reinforces how important this buyout is, that we want to make sure that we get cattle out of there. We did find infection in another herd. For the 22 herds that remain in that management zone, and that represents about 3,500 head of cattle, we want to make sure that we keep any deer that might potentially be infected away from these cattle, and particularly away from the feed that they have, because that's how we think the disease is transmitted mostly between cattle and deer, or from deer to cattle, is that the deer will eat of the feed and then the cattle will come in and eat afterward. So we've done a risk assessment on all of those herds to determine is there a deer issue in that farm, and is there a necessity for fencing, deer-proof fencing to keep the deer out of these areas. And we're looking at not only stored feed but also winter feeding area for the fencing. We determined that 27 premises needed fencing, and the good news is they're all done. So all the fencing is up, and if they weren't, it's a little cold up there now to be drilling holes for fence posts. So it's a good that they're done. That, I'll remind you, was a 90-10 cost share with the producers. So the producer paid 10% of the costs. There were 71,000 linear feet of fence that went up. And again, this is 10-foot fencing to keep deer out. And the total cost to the state in that is going to be about $700,000. That's a bit more than what we had anticipated. And then the cost to the producers was about 10% of that. I just want to finish by thanking everybody again for their support with this. I'm glad to report that things are going extremely well, and I think we're on our way to getting rid of this disease. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Hartman. Any questions for a doctor? Yes, Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you give me an idea of how many feet or miles of 10-foot fence you had to put up?
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebretson, it was 71,000 linear feet of fencing.
Oh, okay.
So the follow-up question is, who remembers our sixth-grade math? How many feet per mile?
5,200.
5,000, Senator Skoy says. Okay, other questions?
That's a big question.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Hartman, you said that there was a few more herds and a few more fences that were had to put up. How's your budget doing on there?
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, we're still in the middle of it, and we're still working the numbers, but I think we're close with what we have. And by the way, Senator Skoy, I want to thank you for all your hard work on this bill. I think we're seeing the fruits of that labor.
Thank you, and it's a very good thing to hear you say that you think you're going to make it under what we did last year.
I'm knocking on wood as they say it. We've had some surprises with this disease, but lately things have been going extremely well.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Carstensen.
Thank you. My name is Michelle Carstensen. I'm the Wildlife Health Program Coordinator with Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and it's a pleasure being here today. I do have a handout. I'm sorry I didn't get in your packet earlier, but if somebody would like to hand these out, that would be greatly appreciated. I also have a brief PowerPoint for you, which is detailed in the handout, to bring you up to speed on our work with the wild deer side of this disease. As Dr. Hartman indicated, we have a small area in northwest Minnesota, which is the focus of this disease outbreak. And where the deer are that are infected is a small area we call it the TB core. And this is a 164 square mile area in northwest Minnesota, centered kind of around the Skyme area. And this map indicates the location of the positive deer that we've found to date. There's a total of 24 deer since we started this effort in 2005 up until this year, through this fall. And again, our prevalence that we've assessed every year remains really low, less than 0.5%, and the geographic distribution of those infected deer have not changed since we started. So basically, how are we managing this disease of deer? We really have two main strategies. One is to reduce deer numbers. That's a great way to try to combat a disease that's released in the wild and out there. And there's many ways to do that, including hunting, allowing additional hunting opportunities and expanded hunts. Special seasons. We also have some more targeted removal efforts through the use of ground sharpshooting and aerial gunning operations, and then also allowing landowners or tenants themselves to remove deer on their properties. The second important component is trying to restrict recreational feeding of deer. And as Dr. Hartman pointed out, one of the main mechanisms for disease transmission with this disease is shared feed. So trying to get at that through preventing the recreational feeding of deer and elk in this area is a great way to try to minimize that risk of this disease being spread. And lastly,
excuse me, Ms. Carstensen, a question on that point. So I would imagine it's mostly homeowners in the area that like to put out apples or corn or something for the deer. Is that what you're talking about? And then how do you get to those people to encourage them not to do the recreational feeding?
The recreational feeding is indeed the type of feed that's not used for agricultural purposes. So it's put out in terms of feeding animals, not through agricultural means. We began our recreational feeding ban in November of 2006, and it started with education, a press release, and information put out locally and regionally on this new ban, And then that first year, we did enforcement efforts, like flying and looking for these type of feeding sites. And then they were visited by enforcement officers and told of the ban. So the first year was sort of informative and educational. And since that time, we've now issued citations, and that enforcement continues.
Okay, thank you. Welcome. Senator Scoy.
Madam Chair, just let me help clarify a little bit about what was going on with regard to deer feeding in this area. Some of the deer feeding that was going on was much more than just a few apples being placed out. They were actually using farm trucks and hauling sugar beet tailings, large concentrations of food, and it was very important that we restrict that and eliminate the nose-to-nose contact of the deer on those feed piles.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's a different story than just, you know, a family chucking out a few apples.
Yeah, it wasn't just apples.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you for the additional comments. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about what we did last winter. We stepped up efforts quite a bit to remove more deer in this core area. We did some ground sharpshooting in winter of 2007. We removed nearly 500 animals that year, but we, with the loss of status that we've already heard and the increase in testing requirements around the state, really getting at the deer issue with more force happened in 2008, and that was a combination of ground sharpshooting and aerial gunning. Through that effort, we removed nearly 1,000 deer in the core, and then an additional deer removed by the landowners. All of these animals were sampled for bovine tuberculosis, and this map just indicates where those animals were taken within the core through those removal operations. And the carcasses were salvaged for venison to local folks that were interested. This is just a couple pictures to show that it's a lot of deer that are being removed in a very short amount of time. All the deer were processed by my staff and others that were helping us and tested for the disease. And then, again, we were trying to give those animals that were looking like they were good to folks that were interested in the venison. Any carcasses, of course, that came in that had any lesions were confiscated and submitted intactly to the lab. But we did give out almost, I'd say, 90% of the deer that we removed was released back for human consumption. And we also sampled across age classes, so it's not just a skewed representation of just older deer. We have sampled a lot of older deer, younger deer, and even fawns, and that helps with our confidence in this theory we have called Alive in 05, which basically is all the deer that we found to date with this disease would have been on the hoof or had been born by June 05 when we found out we had this infection in cattle. And why that's important is that if there's younger deer that we're finding infected, that's an indication that this disease might be persisting in the wild and being spread animal to animal. And by only finding it in older animals and not newer infections, it's a good sign that we might not have infection that's continuing and persisting out there. So that's why this Alive in 05 is a very positive theory. And as Dr. Hartman mentioned, trying to manage that deer-cattle interface is a very important component of these efforts that that he already highlighted as far as what the board's doing with fencing and with risk mitigation efforts at the farm level. Another thing DNR did was to try to increase hunting opportunities, which is a great mechanism for trying to reduce deer numbers. We did that by creating a special permit area to help manage the disease, and that's called Permit Area 101, and that includes all of the TB core area and most of the management zone. And we created some disease management tags at a real low cost, $2.50 per hunter, to have an unlimited number of deer that can be removed from this area, as well as early antlerless seasons and then special late hunts in January. And we also increased the hunting capabilities and the amount of deer that can be removed in the surrounding areas. So we're not just looking at this one permit area as its own island. It's where deer can be moving in from the periphery. That's important as well. So we try to increase the amount of deer that can be removed by hunters in the surrounding areas. So all of these permit areas that I showed in this slide went to an early antlerless or that green color, which means up to 7 deer per hunter can be removed during the legal hunting seasons. That brings us to this fall. We've just completed our special hunt about a week ago. What we did as far as testing for this fall, we sampled about 1,238 deer. And this included deer that were outside the modified zone and as well as inside the TB management zone. And this map depicts the locations of those deer. We do have a memorandum of understanding that we signed with USDA that requires a certain sampling protocol as far as trying to get at deer that are outside the area as well as numbers that are inside the modified zone. And we did not find any clinical suspects, and that is very good news. Each hunting season since we started in 05, we've had clinical deer presented at the station that had lesions in the lungs, chest cavity that we could identify. And none of the deer that we've handled this fall had any sort of symptoms consistent with the disease. Upon our gross examination, the samples are currently at the laboratory for culture, and we won't have final results back for a couple months. But this final table just summarizes the totals that we've sampled in this TB area since 05 and the numbers of positive that we have. So, again, the fall results, right now we have zero that we think are infected, but, again, the culture results will confirm that. And we sampled over 5,000, nearly 5,500 deer from this area with a total of 24 infected cases. And finally, just what our next steps are for the agency is to really stay the course. Our Live in 05 theory is still holding, and we're very thankful for that. We're in the process of setting up a deer survey for the TB core area to look at population numbers, and that will be completed this month. And then another intensive deer removal effort will begin in February and through March to remove deer in that TB core area because we need to keep the pressure on. Even though we have good signs as far as what we think we have for infectious out there, it's a little too soon to stop the removal efforts and to think that we've have a beat. Again, the recreational feeding ban is a very important component. We intend to keep enforcing that and keeping the pressure on deer through hunting and keeping the densities low in those permit areas in that area. And finally, just to continue coordinating our efforts through the Board of Animal Health, the Department of Ag, and USDA. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Carstensen, that's very good news to have no positives. But my questions to Dr. Hartman or maybe to Mr. Martin. So here we are today now, and we've done all the herds that are left in the area and no positives there. And we've gone through this deer hunt now with no positives in deer. Can you walk me through the time frame for getting the rest of the state TB free and then this zone moving up in accreditation?
Madam Chair and Senator Scoey, very good question. Maybe I'll preface it by saying that USDA, after finding TB in three herds in California and some very big dairy herds, is taking a fresh look at their TB program. They had five listening sessions around the United States. One of them was here in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, to hear what's working and what isn't working. So we're anticipating some pretty rapid changes to the TB program. And so I think there's some question about how these state statuses are going to work and where we're going with that. I think that a lot of people are thinking that we should treat this disease as areas, zones, rather than as whole states. So we're still working with them and negotiating with them on how we will progress back up. But my sense is that if we don't find any more infection in cattle herds and we don't find any more infection in deer, that we could move up pretty rapidly. 2 years to move up one status level, 4 years to get to back to where the whole state is free. But it's something that's a little bit fluid at this point.
And Madam Chair and Dr. Hartman, it's contingent on no more positives, but hopefully we don't have any more of those now with the efforts that you guys have all made. And I think, we all thank you for your work in this too, Dr. Hartman and Joel, because you guys have really done a good job, it looks like.
Okay. We have Senator Kubley, Senator Hand, Senator Dill. Senator Kubley.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Hartman. I think, I agree with Senator Scoy. I think your work is certainly to be commended in this area. But, I guess I wonder, will we reach a point where we have complete assurance that there isn't more out there, or will there always be kind of a small margin of error that we don't know for sure, and then we'll have to wait until we get, another identified outbreak, or how does that, how do we go about looking at the future in terms of controlling this problem?
Madam Chair and Senator Kubley, very good question, and I think that's one of the reasons that USDA is reexamining the National Eradication Program to ask the question, do we have the tools to eradicate this disease from the United States, or is it out there in very small pockets all over the country, and we just don't know about it? Because our detection system for it is slaughter surveillance, and it's a slow system. A herd can be infected for several years before you find it that way. So there's a lot of concern about that. Is there disease in North Dakota, too? Is there disease in South Dakota? We just don't know the answer to that. So they're reexamining the whole program based on that. And the truth is, I can speak for cattle, and Michelle can speak for deer, but it's very difficult to know that you don't have any disease at all anywhere in the state. You'd have to test every herd. And by the time you tested every herd in the state, the herds would have changed enough so you still wouldn't have absolute assurance. And that's how we eradicated it the first time, is we did test every herd every 6 years in the state to get rid of it.
Just a follow-up, Madam Chair. I guess, I appreciated the opportunity to come over to the veterinary research labs and go through there, but the vets that we visited with there indicated that that they looked at some of the things that came through that indicated disease, but apparently there isn't really anything that a hunter could recognize in the process of harvesting an animal, whether they had this disease or not. Is it that obscure in noticing that there is a disease-ridden animal?
Madam Chair, it is possible for hunters to see these lesions. And in Michigan, where they've had this disease for quite some time, hunters have flagged deer, basically, that looked like they had lumps and lesions in the lungs or in the chest cavity. And that's part of the education involved in having posters at registration stations and information out to the hunting public on signs to look for. We also publish information in our hunting regulations book on signs for TB. So if the animal has clinical signs, it could be something that a hunter might see. Again, if they're field dressing in the dark in a hurry, they might not be looking, but there might be some lesions that are evident. If it's an earlier infection, it might not be something that's visible to the naked eye, but okay. Laboratory could confirm infection.
Well, thank you.
Senator Scoia, on Senator Kubley's point.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Harmon. To the point about the bovine TB free and how do we assure that we're there? Is there any work going on long-term with tracking and paperwork of deer? I know a number of producers have talked to me about it, that really, there's very limited enforcement on the paperwork that they have on the deer that are coming into the state and into these areas. And is there anything that we should be looking at there kind of longer term?
Madam Chair and Senator Scoia, are you getting to the tracking of cattle and farm deer that come into Minnesota and then leave Minnesota? Yeah, I share those concerns. We've had systems in place for different diseases. We had a system for tracking and identifying for pseudorabies in pigs when we were trying to get rid of that disease. We had a system in place for brucellosis when we were trying to get rid of that disease. But as those diseases all went away, our tracking systems became less effective. And that's what this National Animal Identification System is all about. That effort is to, and that started when we found BSE in the United States. The feeling was that we had to improve our tracking system. Well, that tracking system was supposed, with NAIS was supposed to move forward very rapidly. Well, it hasn't. It's gotten a lot of resistance, and we're still in the part of it where we're trying to identify all the farms in the United States, let alone track all the animals that move. So it's something that needs attention, and it's crucial for our disease control programs.
And one more follow-up. I'm sorry to have so much questions here, but Dr. Hartman, was there any progress made with those RFID tags, those radio tags?
Madam Chair and Senator Scoey, yes, some of the funding that the Board of Animal Health got was used to use these RFID tags in all the cattle that are tested in the MA zone. And interestingly enough, at first, everybody, all the producers thought that that was going to be a detriment. If they had a certain kind of tag in their cattle's ear, they'd go to the sale barn and they'd say, oh, they're from the zone and we don't want them, or we're not going to pay as much for them. Turns out that that didn't happen, and that the producers liked the tags and the use of them. So all of the cows and the calves that we're testing up there are getting those tags. We're able to scan those tags in then into a computer, and when you're done testing a herd that's 400 head, instead of having to go back to your motel room that night and write all those numbers down on a test chart, you just print it off from the computer. So it's pretty amazing. And then the other part of it is, once we go back to that herd next year, and probably these herds we're going to have to test for 4 or 5 years or something like that, you've got all that information on that herd already there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure if you are the right people to respond, but has there been any effort to try to assess what the economic impact to the local economy or to the state economy has been as a result of the, I guess, the outbreak? Or I know we've had costs that we've spent to try to manage it, and that certainly had some, but just what has been the effect on productivity in the agriculture sector? Has anybody looked at that, or do you have an answer for that, or are you still trying to assess that? I'm just curious to know.
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn, we get that question a lot, and we've got it over the past year. What I can tell you is there isn't an exact number on what the impact of this disease has been. The number that we have put out is the value of that livestock sector in the area. I think we all had concerns last winter when we looked at what really was going to happen to the markets due to this. The one good news I can report is, after this last fall for the feeder cattle markets, we really didn't see a big difference in terms of the cattle sales. So while I can't give you an exact number, I can tell you that the worst case scenario that we feared didn't happen. Minnesota cattle still sold, and they still went out of state.
Great, thank you. Senator Dill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. This is an example of the good that government can do. And we have some people in our society that are very negative on government, but there's many good things that government does, and the Board of Animal Health has got a long history of doing good, eradicating and controlling animal diseases, making our livestock industry competitive across this country and around the world. So I'd like to congratulate and thank not only the Board of Animal Health, but the DNR and the Department of Agriculture, and also Senator Scoey for his leadership on this issue, because it looks like we're going to be successful. It's very encouraging to see all those deer that are still negative. Hopefully they'll stay that way. But anyway, thank you, congratulations, and this is, again, an example of the good that government does, because we need government involvement to try to eradicate and control diseases within our population base.
Thank you, Senator Dill. And I think you must have stolen my speech here, because that's exactly what I was going to say, Senator, that this is an example of good government, and I wanted to thank Senator Scoey. I'm from the southeastern corner of the state, and this is happening up in the northwest, and I can tell you that my cattle people and dairy people down in the southeast corner have been very affected in watching this very closely, because one of the first things that I heard 2 years ago when I first came up here is, get the state split, because I have a lot of farmers on the border there that have half their farm is in Iowa, or, you know, they transport back and forth, and this has really been affecting everyone. So I want to thank the DNR, the Board of Health, and the Department of Ag, as well as Senator Scoey, for this really aggressive plan. It was a very aggressive plan and had a lot of concerns from people at the beginning, but boy, we don't want to be Michigan, and I'm sorry, Michiganers, but we really, this is a good thing. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to echo those same regards. I come from that part of the country originally, so I have a lot of friends and family up there, and we're quite concerned about the eradication of their deer whitetail for a long time, and I know that was quite contentious for the DNR to have to deal with. Let me throw a little fly in the ointment here, if I might, about whitetail. A lot of talk going around about lead being used to kill animals. Was lead used, traditionally used, in killing these animals? And if they were, you said there was about 80 to 90% of those carcasses that were, I would assume, processed and given to the public up there. If that were the case, has there been any reports of any illnesses or anything at all from those lead dispatched animals?
Madam Chair and Senator Ingebretson, we don't have any reports. First of all, yes, there was lead ammunition used to remove animals through last winter. We have changed that this year, and our contractor that does the ground removal is USDA Wildlife Services Division, and we have specified non-toxic shot this year, so that's changing. But last year, that was a lead shot that was used. The information we handed out as folks from the public came to pick up carcasses was focused more on bovine tuberculosis and risks in consuming carcasses that may or may not have the disease, as we didn't have final results back and available as we were handing out carcasses. But we weren't providing information at that time on lead. And to my knowledge, we have had no reports of illness relative to the deer.
Senator Ingebretson?
Thank you very much. And just to follow up on that, do you know how many people that might be? That might have consumed those carcasses.
Madam Chairman and Senator Ingebretson, I believe multiple deer were given in almost every occasion. So if we gave out 800 or so deer, it was probably 500 or less people that that may have consumed that venison from the removal efforts.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
If I could add to that point, too. As the Department of Ag, who oversees the venison donation program, it's been controversial. The deer that were taken via the TB efforts, they were not part of the venison donation program. They did not go into processing facilities. It was individuals signing up to take the carcass. So sort of apples and oranges, but I'm sure we'll have plenty of time. Venison donation program through the session, too.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Committee, any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you very much for coming to testify, everyone, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much.
Yes.